And now, Icon Art Radio.
It's Bill Teeple, Alan Cobb, and Donna Colby, and it's Icon Art Radio. And we're talking about the influence of others on our creative output. I don't know. Let's see.
Well, you were making a point about losing our perspective and not mm-hmm. being able to see the forest for the trees. And I think, in a sense, that's what happens to a lot of people when they look at the competition. And, of course, it's a mistake to think of all the other creative people doing their things as competitors. But it can be really overshadowing when you see so many people doing so many things, and some of them have been doing things like what you're doing, and they've been doing them longer, or they have more, you know, skill in some area that's meaningful to your art. I guess the question is, you know, how do you meter that kind of influence on yourself? Do you try to stay up to date on what's happening in your field? It's art, it's not technology. There's no particular need to be up to date on what's happening in your field unless you're trying to market your field. And then, of course, we get into the question of what is your actual definition of being an artist yourself? Does it include marketing your art?
Well, and the basic question to that, too, in light of this whole area of being influenced by magazines or books or whatever, art critics, who actually decides what is art at any particular time? Yeah. Is it the collectors?
Who's the decider?
The critics? You know, the editor of the art magazine? Who goes around and looks at everything that's being created right now and picks out which ones are?
Well, there isn't a god of art hanging over America. And art in America is the American art god decides. And then there's the universal global art god, and they know exactly what's good and bad. It's not like that. It's a kind of fluctuating collective consciousness thing. And it is influenced by the marketplace. It's influenced by taste and reactionary. If things have been a certain way for 10 years, then in the next 10 years or the next generation, especially between generations, there's always a reaction. Mm-hmm. And so there's always this fluctuating. But you mentioned like Picasso and Matisse and some of the greats of the past, and I mentioned, you know, Renoir and Monet and Da Vinci and all of the greats throughout history. They themselves were in a forest and couldn't see the forest for the trees, and yet there was some degree of pushing through and staying true to their vision that carried them through. I'm losing my point.
People say, I'm mainly a writer. And, you know, you read, there's a zillion writing books about writing by writers. And one of the main things most of them say is the way you know that you really are a writer is if you just have to write the same way that you have to breathe. And you read stories about Picasso and Matisse and all of these artists, and you hear a similar thing that, you know, there may not be an intellectual explanation of why I decided at a certain point to be an artist, but there's something inside. It's probably that thing that Kandinsky talked about the inner necessity, that there's inner necessity that's an ongoing thing about what you do every day with your art, but there's probably an inner necessity that sparked you at some point in your life that I need to express this way through color and form or through sound or through words or whatever, and that drive can be a small one where you just do it as a hobby on Sundays, or it can be an enormous one that governs your entire life.
Oh, and I got my point back. And almost every one of these guys broke the rules. And they didn't break the rules in order to do something different. They broke the rules just because they had to make this expression that they needed to make. So then a whole new school of art develops around the way they broke the rules, mm-hmm. an imitation mm-hmm. of what they did, and yet that's not why they did it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's also the question of, you know, how you identify yourself in terms of your activities. I mean, a lot of people have a day job and they identify with the day job and they consider the art that they do to be something that they do that doesn't count, that doesn't define who they are. When you said, I'm a writer primarily, a minute ago, I was thinking, gosh, what am I primarily? And I realized that I have no answer to that. I don't know what I am primarily, because to me, it's the imperative is to be creative, and I can't stop being creative, but I also can't stop hopping from one, you know, field to another. So I sort of have been calling myself a composer or a sound art artist, which is a lovely designation. But that's not really true. I mean, I've just started this little publishing company, and I've been a writer all my life, but I've also been a photographer all my life. And, you know, I've also been building things. I've been an inventor all my life, and I'm sure I'd be better at any one of those if I had excluded the other ones.
But you know what happens with you? I mean, this is my own observation of you mm-hmm. specifically. You are so intensely curious.
Yes.
And that seems to be the thing that motivates you so that you can't just stick with one thing, because you're doing one thing and, you know, possibly you could master it to some greater degree if you stuck at one thing. But your curiosity will pop up in a different direction, and you have to go in that direction. And that's, I think, part of the inner necessity thing, that you have to follow that, because that's where the energy is going. And otherwise, it's just tedious duty if you just decide, okay, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm going to stick with this one thing.
Yeah, and I'm just going to write another book. But in fact, the thing that's curious is that there's still sort of an artist component to it all, because not only do I hop from one field to another, and it's not like an infinite number of fields, it's only probably five, but that's, you know, four more than usual, I guess. And, you know, and I'm always concerned about ending up being a jack of all trades, master of none. But at the same time, what really gives me joy in what I do is exploring something, finding out something about it, and then manifesting an example of what I found out and seeing someone else get it. And if it doesn't go that full circle to the point where someone else gets it and says, oh, wow, that really is interesting, or that really is cool or frightening, or, you know, whatever, if it doesn't go all the way full circle, then, you know, I don't feel like I've finished, and I keep going. So it's partly a process of expressing, you know, and I think an awful lot of artists do need that audience component in the process. They don't want to just paint and leave them in the attic and we'll discover it when they've passed away and they empty the house. There are people like that, but I think they're the exception. And I guess that's part of, you know, our kind of overarching topic, which is, you know, what is the influence of other people? And to a certain extent, the other people, other artists, and audience are an essential component in the creative process.
Listening and speaking, you know, we listen and look and take in the gathering of what's out there, and then there's our own creative process and expression, and then there's somebody else listening and looking at what we're doing, and so the whole thing connects us all.
Yeah.
So the feedback is really quite important.
Yeah.
And if you let the feedback intimidate you so that then you mm-hmm. say, oh, I better change it so I'll make him happy, that's not so good. But if the feedback helps you to figure out how to say it better so that you get across what you're trying to get across instead of missing the target, which happens all the time, and what you want to do is hit the target, then the feedback's valuable and it's necessary.
Well, that's what I love about this whole, you know, vague field that I'm in of art, and that is that it's sort of forces me to balance things. I have to balance all of these inputs. I can't just say, oh my gosh, the critics are all telling me to do this, or gee, the last five people I played one of my compositions for all thought it was horrible. Does that mean I shouldn't be doing any more like that? Does that mean I'm not getting to my audience? Or does it mean that they probably aren't my current audience, but maybe they like something I did last year or something I might do next year? And so you have to be constantly, you know, responding. And I think it's got to be, you know, at the level of feeling. You've got to respond intuitively to not the validity of the input, because it's all real input, but you've got to respond intuitively to the relevance of the input, to mm-hmm. the usefulness, the point of the input. It's like nature's telling you something every time someone reacts to your work.
And the point in your work, it's like, you know, as a writer, if I want to have somebody read my first draft of something, I'm very careful who I choose to read that. Because let's say I'm working on a story that's based on very subtle inner conflicts in a character, I'm not going to give it to somebody who only reads thrillers and action novels and doesn't even like that kind of writing, because it's not going to help me. So I think that's the same thing with any kind of art. If you're in a really vulnerable state when you're showing it to somebody, you have to be a lot more careful. Sometimes you'll produce a work that for some reason or another, you just love it. Within yourself, it's exactly what you wanted to say. It worked, and you're not afraid to show it to anybody. It doesn't matter what anybody says about it, because you're just going to love it anyway. So it is a tricky thing, you know, that you have to be aware of when you're sharing your work with others.
And sometimes things plop out that you have no understanding of why that just happened. And so then you sort of want to bounce it off to somebody to see what they get out of it.
And with a lot of my work, I think I know what I just did, and when other people listen to it, they respond to it in ways that I never predicted.
Well, I think that's one of the more interesting and curious parts, how people will bring to my work on the wall or any artwork that I might show in the gallery, and they will take something. They will make a comment about what they're experiencing as it bounces off of their awareness that was not what I was seeing, and I know is not what the artist was working at, and yet it's in there. Mm-hmm. And and if I'm dealing specifically with my work, I think it's just marvelous. And I just don't really understand the mystery of that, because this person is possibly going to buy that and put it on the wall and be getting out of it for the rest of its life in their life. And I didn't consciously put it in there, but it's in there. But then now it's in my awareness when I make future ones. It's very fun and interesting.
This gets at really subtle mechanics of perception and you know, we all see life from a different angle, and we all view works of art from a different angle. And I love to eavesdrop on conversations in the great art museums when you're all standing in front of some work that's incredibly famous and everybody has seen it hundreds of times, and you're listening to the comments, that the reactions that other people are having to this same painting, and the range is astonishing.
Yeah. I guess for me, the secret is in recognizing that everything that I do, whether it's finished or interrupted, is really preparation for what I'm doing next. And then the input is always helpful, even if it's negative. It doesn't really matter what kind of input it is. But I know as I'm getting the feedback that somewhere in the unfathomable portion of my creative machinery, I'm getting better at bridging gaps. Sometimes gaps I don't even know exist, but I'm getting better at taking impulses so faint they can only barely be perceived, all the way out into the world where a group of people can, you know, respond to them. And along the way, that transformation from a faint idea to a fully realized work of something goes through my individuality. And I don't know what I am. I don't know what I'm supposed to be. And I don't know what I'm doing. And through these artistic and creative practices, you know, it's a way to sort of happily not know all of those things. It's fun to not know, and instead of just being utterly intimidating.
No, I love this point we're getting on to.
The not knowing point, the creation of a vacuum, even doubts open, you know, to me, that then sends me out to investigate. And as I investigate, sometimes my investigation takes me to something that isn't even technically related to art. I'll go for a walk in the morning. I'll be walking to the post office to drop off the Netflix movie that I watched the night before. And as I'm walking down the street, like this happened in the summer, I suddenly saw that somebody had planted, or else it had accidentally gotten there, a corn stalk just at a corner of a street in town. It was like 3rd and Adams or something like that. And seeing something incongruous on my morning walk sparked some direction in me, and yeah. I went back and, well, what I did that day was I got out a camera. I didn't take a photograph of that corn stalk, but it just made me think, oh, this is a fun idea. You take two things that are not related to each other and put them together and mm-hmm. create something with yeah. that. And to me, that's more interesting and more playful than knowing where I'm going and saying, all right, now I'm going to make a series of paintings where I explore the relationship of this and this. And mm-hmm. every day I sit down and I'm working on that same problem.
Well, the incongruous is, you know, kind of by definition, you know, a revealing of what's expected. You know, by being unexpected, it sheds light on this sort of world of the, you know, unchanging that we're constantly trying to build. I think the, you know, part of the human physiology is designed to make life constant. And, you know, obviously we have all these, you know, cycles and things built into us. We wake and we sleep and we eat and, you know, we do these things on a very regular basis. And in the midst of that regularity, you know, you can become a biological machine and you can go to sleep and just keep going through the motions. And the subtle part of that is that the dweller in the body isn't that personality that goes to sleep. There's still a light in there that's observing the whole thing. And not knowing what you're doing can be part of just being befuddled by life, or it can be part of recognizing that at some level you're not actually doing it anyway. And again, art is an opportunity. Creating art is, or just creating, if you will, is an opportunity to kind of live in that domain for a little while where you don't know how you're doing it. And it's right in your face. The more you try to know how you're doing it, the less you can do it. So you have to let go if you're going to have any success at all. And it becomes like a training ground for, you know, learning where the button is that makes you let go. And of course, the ultimate subtlety of it is that button doesn't exist either, and you never do find the button that makes you let go. It's something even fainter, even more inside, that isn't, you know, grabbing onto things and isn't trying to force the next moment to be like the last one. And
Because it comes in the side door sometimes anyway. This is what happens when I'm writing my novel. I started out with a plot in mind, and I even like wrote down the whole outline. And then, as everybody tells you when you write a novel, the characters take over at a certain point, and you don't know where you're going, and that definitely happened. But it's kind of a balanced thing where I have to go back and forth every once in a while and do another story progression and consolidate the plot where it's now the new plot, where that is. Mm-hmm. And then the same thing happens. I'll be working along on that plot, and then all of a sudden some character will come shooting in out of the blue and change everything.
Yeah.
And so you have to do a little bit of both, I think. You have to have goals, and you have to have directions and a trajectory.
Right.
And then
that's the balance.
Yeah, and it's this thing that he just described of the human nature, or the nature of progress, is that we're constantly trying to find a safe niche.
Yeah.
We have to. We have to constantly be constructing a platform to grow from.
Right.
But the inside of us wants to keep expanding and changing and growing. And so it's an evolving path. And as we're talking, this sort of definition of art, which we're always trying to define here, it's this emerging sort of quest for wholeness, seems to be what's going on. Mm-hmm. And the novel is sort of happening in a way beyond you.
Mm-hmm.
There's other like trans Donna elements that are writing this novel, obviously.
Yeah.
And then we're talking about Alan, and Alan is like got these five different areas going. Well, it's all each of your attempts, and we could talk about me too, I'm sure, are to weave wholeness. If you decide that your art is producing X and you just continue to turn those out for the marketplace or to get your name in Art in America, then you have your reward, but you don't have wholeness.
Yeah.
We see a lot of art that's highly produced in that magazine. It's almost like those guys, a lot of the work that you'll see in the art world today is like they're producing an artwork almost like a television show.
Yeah. Mm.
And it's not that you can feel that this, and you've mentioned that there's some you feel more like they're on to some quest, and others it's more that they're producing a show.
Yeah.
And I propose that what it's all about is this quest of to be more whole.
Yeah. You can't really say that something is or isn't art, but you can say that something does or doesn't connect with a deeper level of your perception. And I think if you classify the art that you look at on the basis of whether it connects with a deeper level or not, it doesn't matter whether it's great art or whether the guy doing it was actually profound or superficial. It's just that's where the art is going to be worth spending your time on, either as a visitor to a gallery or a listener in an audience, or as a painter painting the painting or writing the novel. Because it's fun to visit a manufacturing plant and see how they do it. But after you've seen how they do it, the thought of doing it over and over and over, day in and day out, is anathema to most of those people who think of themselves as being, in some sense, artists.
And yet some people who have jobs like that, like in commercial art, let's say. Mm-hmm. I mean, one time I was walking with my brother in New York City, and it was some odd little street, and there was a door that was pretty much unmarked. I walked into the door, and it was a store that had vintage posters of all sorts, original copies of them, piled up on tables, and you could just like look through them. I was transported into ecstasy looking at these posters, the colors and the designs. It was the most beautiful art, and this was advertising.
Of course. You cannot distinguish.
There's no line.
You find an enlightened being and a consummate craftsman, probably, maybe doing rubber stamps.
Yeah.
A rubber stamp factory, designing rubber stamps.
Yeah.
And that one rubber stamp will stand out as being like enlightened.
Yeah.
And you can't miss it. Well,
I remember being shocked in LA. We were at one point when we were running Malibu Art Exchange. The idea was to sell very fine giclée, very high quality giclée images to record stores, because we used to have record stores in those days, and we'd go to Tower Records and tell them that we could produce an 8-foot by 8-foot reproduction of the hot new CD that had just come out, and we could do it for much less money than they were currently spending. And what they had on, if you've been to the big record stores in LA back when we had them, there were these 8-foot square giant CD covers on the sides of the store. And if you got up to them, they're actually made out of 2 4-by-8 sheets of plywood padlocked to the building. Well, they're painted by individual painters. They're actually hand-painted in a warehouse by artists. And they paint them, they put them up on the building, they come back 2 weeks later and they take them down, take them back to the warehouse and paint them white. And then they paint a new album cover on it. These guys are unquestionably artists. And yet, you know, what they're doing is completely different from what we usually think of as, you know, what an artist does.
But did they want the beautifully produced printed images, or did
No, they weren't interested.
Was too much money?
No, they weren't interested because they already had a system in place.
Okay.
And they just didn't need to change.
I just wonder if they appreciated the hands-on.
No,
artwork.
It wasn't that. It was that we really couldn't compete on price.
Well, there you have it. Bye bye for Icon Art Radio.
Listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.